this is a hot topic, and another one, you know, and that's binding. The Immaculate Conception is now binding on this. Another one is that Mary was assumed bodily into heaven. You know, you don't find that anywhere in the Bible. It's just, but that doesn't bother Catholics, because they say that God, for God's own reasons and God's own purpose and on God's own time, can choose to add more revelation or more doctrine than is already the case. Hence, you can have this thing, and now there's a strong sort of counter-resurgence in the Catholic Church among the conservatives, and we'll talk about that a lot today, which want to hold on to the older traditional teachings about Mary, because they don't want to make Mary into a feminist. See, Mary is always who Mary was. Was Mary a feminist in old fact? No, she was somebody who stayed her place.
Yes.
So, yeah, right, absolutely. And she was a feminist.
Oh, but liberation theology picks up Mary that gives the Magnificat. The revolution. Mary the revolutionary.
Well, absolutely. And we've got tapes here of Rosemary Russo, you know, who's up here and doing these things. And that's where this sort of thing just really, in a sense, got started. And then there's the Mary of the miraculous, you know, Our Lady of Guadalupe and all this,
yes,
who was very powerful and strong and attractive in Latin American countries. There's that image of Mary that's so, and every so often you'll see, you know, Mary's supposed to be visiting places, and then you'll see tens of thousands of people. I'm always impressed when there's a vision somewhere, there'll be tens of thousands of people who will show up. I mean, this is not, some people get the idea, especially in sort of, you know, Protestant circles, that Mary is pretty much, you know, that old Mary stuff is pretty well gone. That's not the case at all. It's very strong and powerful in many, in many circles. So they'll see pictures or cloud formations, and that will be Mary. And then there'll be medals. And in fact, near where we live in Wisconsin,
where is there's a shrine.
There's a shrine, yeah.
We have a friend of mine up the, I forgot where it is. It's in Illinois, isn't it?
It's in the central, west central Wisconsin. It'll come to me at lunch, I'm sure, where you are. You know, not on this, but it attracts, you know, people. And words, you know, the healing shrine in southern France, so tens of thousands of people a year will go there all the time. So the old piety is simply very, very much alive, and there's a good, lively article. I know the author, the editor, the religion editor is Kenneth Woodward, and he's done a very good job of this piece. And if you have the chance, by all means, look at it. So we'll get into that. Okay. Let's see, where I had it organized when I left home.
The jokes.
Yeah, you're going
to
stand up.
Well, you assume we didn't have to be reminded in that.
This really, since we're on here, okay, well, that kind of that reminds me, I've got it, and tomorrow I'm doing the Jewish community, so remind me, I've got a rabbi priest joke for conclusion.
One of many.
But this one is wonderful. This is Andrew Greeley, Father Andrew Greeley, who was interesting, to say it mildly. He has his own Book of the Month Club. He writes so much. He's both a trained sociologist and a novelist and an iconoclastic hellraiser. I guess that's the only word I can say for Father Greeley and so on. But anyway, he wrote a piece, you know, and I'll talk about this later too. Why do Catholics, with all their troubles, and goodness knows they have an enormous number of troubles, why do Catholics stay in the, you know, in the church? What is it that holds them? And then I want to have this joke here first, and then we'll sort of lead to that as we get towards the end. When I was in grammar school in the mid-1930s, a nun told a story that sums up why people stay Catholic. One day, Jesus went on a tour of the heavenly city and noted that there were certain new residents who ought not be there until they had put in a long time in purgatory, and some of them only on a last-minute appeal. He stormed out of the gate where Peter was checking the day's intake on his Compact 486DX. He said, I edited the non-story. You put in the Compact 486. I even know what 486 means myself. So. Okay. Next to which, on his workstation, was a fishing pole and a papal crown. Next to Peter's workstation was a papal crown and a fishing pole. You failed again, Peter, Simon Peter, said the Lord. What have I done now? You let a lot of people in that don't belong. I didn't do it. Well, who did? You won't like it. Tell me anyway. I turn them around away from the front gate, and then they go around to the back door, and your mother let them in.
That's it?
Mary lets them in the back
door. That's the whole story.
That's a marvelous story.
It's a wonderful story, right?
Yeah, I'm speaking as a Catholic, by the way.
Yes. He was Lutheran, now he's Catholic.
Mary left them in the back door. She's, you know, the mother, the forgiveness, you know, the forgiveness, compassion sort of thing. Yeah. Well, right.
Jesus is rigorous, that Mary is like a good mother, and
right, long suffering, accepting, kind, generous, all these, yeah, all those feminine things, that female things that they're supposed to be. Okay,
yeah, that too, feminist.
We're supposed to be talking here about this trading jokes. We're supposed to be talking about old time to new time religion, and that's what I want to try to do. With your comments, I don't have to encourage you, obviously, so far to, you know, that's good. And the old time religion, two historical things have to be said first about the old time religion with the Catholic Church. First of all, and I'm talking about in America, not Canada or Mexico or anything else, but in the United States, okay. First, that from the very beginning, and this still influences much of its, you know, its program today, it's an immigrant church. You took the Catholic Church and you transplanted it from all the different countries in Europe, Ireland and Italy and Poland and France and all these places, and you transplanted it in this country. And there's a wonderful novel I forgot to put on the board that I always like to remember, Willa Cather, Death Comes for the Archbishop. It's a wonderful, wonderful novel. Sort of a history of the Catholic Church in America in the Southwest, down in Durango and Santa Fe. And Willa Cather, Death Comes for the Archbishop. And I just can't say enough about that. It's a history, and it's not loaded or anything. It's just a very good, straightforward thing, and it's got a good plot.
Who is the author?
Willa Cather, C-A-T-H-E-R. Willa Cather, Death Comes for the Archbishop. It's a good read. It's a page turner, as they call it. And you, so on. Okay. Now, the important point is that for the Catholic Church in this country for a long time, there was enormous internal division because each country, and this is where what made me think of the Catholic book, each country had its own religious style of Catholicism in this country. Irish Catholicism was a lot different than Italian Catholicism, and French was a lot different than Polish Catholicism. And for a long time in this country, the churches, and this is true of the Protestant churches, to try very hard to hold on to their, you know, their immigrant identity. The language, the mother tongue, the clothes, the food, the culture, the parochial schools, all of these things were important because the one source of security that the Catholics had in this country for a long time was the church. They came over here, you know, it's like the Jews, I'll talk about this tomorrow also. They were, you know, really strangers in a foreign land, and the one place where they could sort of plug in and sort of survive in this country was in the immigrant church. So the immigrant church stayed alive for a long, long time. And just now, in the last, 15, 20 years, you really don't see, you know, the immigrant church as that powerful anymore. I'd like to give an example. Dwayne knows that I wrote a book just recently on what I call it, 25 Bicycle Trails in Southeast Minnesota. I like riding bikes. And I found there's just about 20 miles away, there is a very strong Slavic Catholic community, New Prague, with Lonsdale and Montgomery and Vesely and all these places, sure. Very strong, and it's absolutely fascinating. Suddenly, when I'm riding on my bike, there's an Assembly of Church God in New Prague. There is a United Methodist Church in New Prague. This is news. I mean, this is big change that has taken place because that wouldn't have happened even 10 years ago. But they are there now, and that means that there's through intermarriage, I suppose, you know, people moving around and all the rest of these things, there are, you know, churches coming in, and the old Slavic, you know, identity is beginning to break down. In Northfield, I was in the National Guard, and I learned the Slavic identity because when I was in the Guard, we had Vosekas and Skluzaceks and all the others, along with the Olsons and Larsons and Johnsons. It's an interesting combination. Let your head there, but it's a strong. And if you're ever there, two reasons to go to New Prague. One is one of the greatest restaurants I've ever been in, Schumacher's, which is German and Slavic cuisine. It's wonderful food. And the other is a great church they have there. It's called St. Wenceslaus. Mm-hmm. And I would recommend that church to anybody. I mean, just Peter would be happy there. He's showing pictures now about great church architecture. And that one, St. Wenceslaus in New Prague, or New Prague, as it were, Prague from Czechoslovakia, drawn right over here. Okay, I think that's important as an indication of this. But for a long time, the church held on to its very conservative traditional nature. That's what I'm trying to say, old-time tradition, because at the same time, they were trying to hold on to the culture, the language, the food, the clothes, the parochial schools, all these things, keeping the children, especially marrying within the faith. That's, I can't stress that strongly enough. I suppose that's more sociology than history, but nevertheless, it was so true for such a long time. And I think I told you this was true in the Lutheran Church, too. My brother was in the Marine Corps in World War II, and he met Frieda Heist when he was in the Marine Corps. She was in the 5th Division, also out of Camp Pendleton. She was Methodist, and they fell in love and decided to get married when Curtis got back. And you would have thought when Curtis brought a Methodist back to my hometown, 100% straight leg Obi. I mean, it's pure leg Obi. Garrison Keillor had to have grown out of my Island. I mean, no question. Anyway, you would have thought that, you know, for the people, that Frieda would have been a member of some African tribe or something, and not just a good United Methodist from the panhandle of Texas, which she was. But that was a major, major thing. Okay, that lasted for a long time on this. And the second problem, I think, or the second issue that kept the old-time religion very dominant in the Catholic Church for a long time was the, you know, the everlasting, you know, problems that have gone on between the clergy and the laity. This is an issue which, in a sense, goes on today, but in the Catholic Church was very strong, because when the priests got over here, the priests were always the ones who were the best educated. Most of the time, their parishes had very little through no, you know, just because that's the way it was. They had very little, if any, kind of education at all. And the priests were the ones who helped the people become Americanized. For instance, there are all kinds of stories in New York, in the Irish parishes, for instance, or in Boston, where the Italian ones. On this, say a young man got in trouble with the law, didn't know the language, parents didn't know the language, they were simple, you know, honest, simple peasants, and it was the priest who knew how to bail the boy out or get him out of trouble. The priest who knew how to get, you know, people jobs. The priest who knew how to deal with the local politicians. And all these things. And so the priests, for a long time, really were in control. And in the Catholic Church, for a long time, there was very little, if any, at least public dissension. When the priest spoke, that was it. You didn't have discussions about issues or anything else. The priest spoke, and that was it. And I remember once, I was up visiting some good friends. They were Catholics up in Newburyport, Massachusetts. And they took us to Mass, and we went. And there had been some Jehovah's Witnesses in there trying to do things, and the priest just said, don't talk to them. I mean, he didn't sort of go into any kind of explanation, but he simply said, don't talk to them, and the people said they agreed, they wouldn't talk to them. That was the end of that. Okay. So what I'm trying to say is that with the immigrant church and with the overwhelming power and control of the whole church apparatus by the Catholic hierarchy, the church stayed very, very conservative for a long, long period of time. And we all know this, I'm sure you all had the experiences we did, where when you grew up, you didn't associate, you know, with the others. We didn't, in my hometown, we didn't buy from the Catholic grocer. They didn't buy from my dad, who had George's Hardware. That was simply the way, you know, the world was. You didn't date the other ones. A very, very sort of clear, rigid sort of differentiation there. And I remember vividly the first time I met somebody who could sort of carry on what I thought was an intelligent conversation. I was at a college seminar program through the Danforth Foundation, and I was sitting in the Chicago Depot to take the train up to where it was going to be in Michigan, and at the end of the bench there was another fellow about my age. I could see he was college, and he sort of looked at me and I sort of looked at him, and it turned out he was Frank Handler, and he was a Notre Dame graduate and I was a St. Olaf graduate. This was 1952, and we slowly started moving towards each other. No, we're not supposed to do that, and all the rest of these things. And finally we got so interested and we found out we had so much in common, we talked, you know, all the way through, and suddenly we didn't even realize we were up to Grand Rapids for the conference, because it was the first time he had that experience too. Notre Dame at that time was very sheltered and isolated about this provincial St. Olaf.
Before Canute Rackney, huh?
Well, no.
You're the exception here.
He was in the 20s. Right? Yeah. And it's not true with Canute Rockney. Anybody knows Northfield. There's people said, well, Canute Rockney really wanted to coach football at St. Olaf. It's not true, because they saw that he came from Norway, he had to be Lutheran, and we were the best Lutheran college, so therefore that was the idea. But think of St. Olaf playing Navy, or St. Olaf playing Southern Cal, or something else like that. That's what happened in Notre Dame. They didn't have anything in football before old Canute. But he was a loyal, like Lou Holtz, he was a loyal Catholic,
that's true.
Kept them and held them. Okay, rewind on this. Now, it changes in the 1950s. The old-time religion really breaks down in the 1950s, and it's a story which some of you know, but I want to summarize just the highlights. And it really, in a sense, has to do with one person, and that's John 23. And then, you know, as I say with other people, nobody doesn't like Pope John 23. He was one of the most remarkable people, Jews, Catholics, Protestants, agnostics, activists, everybody, you know, likes John 23. And his election really is an indication of, you know, if you want to call it the realities within the political realities within the Catholic Church. And it's going to show up again now with John Paul. This is coming. He's feeble and weak, and they say he did pretty well with that big youth rally in Paris, even though it was terrible heat and all the rest of these things, but they say he gets very tired. So obviously we don't hear about it, but there are things going on, you know, politicking going on now within the church. Okay. Because the cardinals, some of you might not know, the cardinals are the ones who elect the pope. And they have a very good system of doing things. They lock the cardinals in, and you can't get out until you elect the pope. I mean, you can't refer it back to committee. You can't say, let's have another study on this. Let's have a blue chip task presidential fact-finding committee to do these things. They stay on, then if they take a vote and the black smoke comes up, that means they haven't elected. And then when the white smoke comes up, that means from a little chimney in the Vatican, that means that the pope is, you know, has been elected. And then the crowd goes, Viva el Papa, and they are all excited about this because they always have 500,000 people on Vatican Square, which is a lot more than Lutherans ever get out to. So anyway, I'll be talking about the conservatives and moderates here. And they were dead even. I mean, neither side had anything near a substantial majority as to who the next, you know, pope should be. So in a very, what I would call, realistic way, what they did, they chose somebody who was very old. In other words, he would die soon, and they would, in the time in between, they would have the chance, both sides would have a chance to politic. I mean, that's about as realistic as you can get. He was 77, I think, when he was elected pope, if I'm not mistaken.
Pretty old.
Something way out there, yeah, right. Just sort of,
they're buying time.
I'm sorry?
They're just buying time to get the coalition.
How does this have to do, what does this have to do with the kingdom of God? I mean, you elect an old man because he's going to die soon. I mean, that's a great way for choosing Christ's true vicar on earth. And I'm just being a little bit sarcastic on that, but I admire this because they would probably still be there sending up, you know, smoke signals, black smoke signals if they hadn't come up with John. I mean, something would have to be done. Okay. So John surprised everybody. He was elected, and in 1959 he announced Vatican II. Vatican II, the first major overhaul of everything Catholic, you know, for something like 400 years. I think it was since the Council of Trent that they had the last major Vatican, you know, conference or committee. You can't call it a convention, but the last major Catholic roundup of everybody around the world, and all the cardinals came. And I can remember vividly. I was used to sort of the more drab, you know.
Well, Vatican I never ended, did it?
Not officially, I don't think, but they have ways of sort of, you know, sort of like.
Until, I mean, century before, let's, yeah, go ahead.
And then I remember vividly because I was used to the more drab, austere American Catholic style, and suddenly in the cover of Life magazine and the pictures in Life magazine with full color, you had all the colorful, paraphernalia and everything else that all the rest of the Catholics wore. And I was amazed by this, and even some of the flying nun habits, you know, you remember, like, and all these things came in, and that was an opening up to me. I use it not sarcastically, but as an example of, you know, the global dimension of the Catholic Church, which I really didn't know very much about. And they debated for 3 years. I mean, they went at it for three. It started in 1962, which took them that long to get ready, get the agenda. And in 1964, they sort of made their statements. And basically what happened, just to summarize here very quickly, was that there had been obviously the struggle between the moderates and the conservatives, and in every important way the moderates won. They had thought at the beginning that maybe, yes, there was some need for some sort of change here and there, but it was pretty much, they thought, just a housekeeping sort of thing, you know, open up the windows and let in a little more air, a little more sunshine and everything. But then, to the surprise of everybody, they made some huge changes because the moderates had the idea, and this is important here, the moderates had the idea that the church was a historically conditioned, the church was a part of the culture, and that therefore the church, you know, should at certain times be ready to make certain significant kinds of changes. They were ready to admit, for instance, that the church had made some horrendous mistakes. Galileo would be wrong. And they did, I say that because just about 10 years ago they admitted they were wrong on Galileo, you can all allow these things. And of course, the most spectacular one of all would be the Inquisition. If you like spectacular mistakes and all the rest of these things. And so therefore, they argued that the church should be open to new forces, new changes that have taken place, you know, in the larger, you know, secular kind of society. The conservatives, on the other hand, followed, and we'll talk about this, pretty much what they call the magic city, that the church itself was, you know, the one true faith that was handed on, built on Peter, Petrion, you know, Dr. Melloch, Peter, and Thomas, and Dr. Andrew, and Jim. And that the church, yes, it made some mistakes, but basically the church should remain the same that it has, you know, in the last, let's say, 1900 years. Cautious attitude towards some sort of changes. And this is basically what's going on. I got a long thing here from the New York Times on this is basically the conflict that's going on within the Catholic Church today. They're getting ready for the new change, because what this Pope did, and I say this straightforward, when he had the opportunity, you know, he's this interesting combination in his social activism and his care for the poor and all these other things. I mean, he's very, what we would call moderate or progressive. I mean, there's a deep, genuine concern of John Paul for the poor, yet on other issues, you know, he's rock-rib conservative. Very, very strict, extremely so. And what he's done, obviously, is put his own people in as the archbishops, so in the key archbiocese, in our archdiocese, I should say, in the country. O'Connor in New York and Bernard Law up in Boston, they have a Harvard PhD in theology, you know, who became a cardinal, he's a cardinal too, as a bishop, but very conservative. I haven't heard in Chicago, have they got a successor for
Oh, yes.
Yeah. They have
Brandon. Because Bernadette was a moderate. And then they can't get rid of, you had this wonderful fellow out here in Seattle. Hunt was it? He was an activist, anti-war activist. Started with H, didn't it? Oh, what was his name?
Huntsman.
Who? I can't remember. And in Milwaukee, they have a, you know.
Weakland,
yeah, quite a progressive.
Markable person.
And a lot of the Catholics don't like him because he's so progressive and he could care less. I read his autobiography, and that's a wonderful story. Hunthausen. That's the one. So he was the one, the whole business.
The anti-war.
When they brought in the atomic submarine, and we had some loose ends going out in dinghies to try to stop it along with the Catholics and so on. Anyway, I'm on the
side. We brought Archbishop George from Portland.
George, that's the name.
He is a wonderful
person. San Francisco.
He was from Portland. We just caught him in Portland.
Good man.
Yes.
Okay, I know nothing about him then.
Yes.
Glad to hear it, because
They bumped him up to Chicago because the other one died.
Sure.
So we're again with that one, which really doesn't bother us. We go to a Catholic and Lutheran church. So.
Oh,
I won't tell.
That's fine.
Well, I mean, the like you say, Hunthausen and Weakland, these guys are very popular in Lutheran circles.
Yes, very much.
More George will be too.
Right.
Oh, good.
A marvelous person.
So the struggle is on there, and it's going to stay on. And a lot of people, in Woodward himself is Catholic. He sees this thing about Mary as the next sort of step. They want to get it in place either before John Paul dies or before the millennium comes. We got talking on the millennium this morning. They sort of think there's going to be some huge thing that's going to occur on the millennium, and I don't. But that's another story. Okay. So what I'm trying to suggest is that. This opened up, you know, the changes in the church, and the changes became very extensive, and they came very quickly. First of all, the Mass went from Latin to English or to the indigenous
vernacular, yeah.
Vernacular, right. And that was, and the Pope, you know, the Pope, the priest stood around and faced the audience instead of the back to the audience and lifting or elevating the host and the, you know, all the rest of the things. That was important, speaking to the people. And this was true, you know, in all the other countries too, you know, all around the world. Second was that they made some major alterations in some rather significant doctrines, which we don't have to talk about here, but they were open to this sort of thing, and they got away from the idea that we should hold on to a doctrine just because it's always been there. But the thing that surprised most people, besides the Mass, of course, because that was, you know, a public thing and all of this, was that the churches, the Catholic churches, became much, much more involved in what we would call activism. For the poor, for youth, for the old people, the war thing. And it was right in the course of the 1960s that all this occurred, with all the activism in this country, with the ecological movement, with the civil rights movement, with the peace movement, all the others that were occurring at this time. And there had been lots of Catholics who had been waiting, both clergy and laity, who had been waiting for this, and now suddenly here was the opportunity sort of to break into and getting involved in these things, because the church wanted them to do that. They had a much greater public presence. And of course, and I mentioned this the very first day back on Monday, one of the most amazing, you know, developments here in American history was that suddenly the church had changed so much that two priests could be arrested and go to jail. Can you imagine this happening in the old-time religion? I'm talking about the Barrington brothers, obviously. But this would not have happened in the old-time religion. But they stayed within the church, I think rather tenuously, for a while. But basically, it's an indication of how far the church, I mean, certain people in the church have gone to get involved in issues, and they weren't worried that they were going to be excommunicated or somehow disciplined by the hierarchy. That's the point I'm trying to make. There was that sort of thing, and all sorts of other things that happened. I know little things. I like to tell this one story of little things, like on Fish on Friday. Would be a good example. The Minneapolis Star Tribune, no, 20 years ago, they took a poll, and they called up 10 parochial schools, so Protestant and Catholic in this country, on a Friday, and said, "What are you serving today?" On a Friday, and the Catholic Church was the only one that was serving meat. I thought that was interesting. the others were all serving fish, right? And I like to go and often and talk with the Northfield Ministers Association, and just small things. Most of them come on their clerics, and the Catholic Father Joel comes in, and he comes in a sweatsuit. And it's not a big deal at all for it. And then the whole thing with music. There's near us, it's a little town on the Mississippi River called Frontenac, and there's a Catholic villa there, Renewal Center. We were over there for a 3-day meeting, and at the end the bus hadn't come to take us back to Northfield yet, and there were four sisters who were operating the place, did all the things with this, and they got out their guitars and they sang, good Protestant Bible thumping hymns. And we, this was all brand new to us. They sounded more Lutheran, or at least more evangelical, than the rest. And we sort of thought they were going to come out in what they call their penguin suits and all the rest of the things. And I say that because that's what they say about themselves. I got to know some of the sisters up at the College of St. Catherine, and they would come out, "Oh dear, I have to wear my penguin suit today." And all this, the enormous kinds of changes that took place, and it caused, great conflict within the church. A few dropped out. Just way in the southeast corner of Minnesota, there was a priest, in a way he's like the Anglicans, who decided that it was more important to keep the old-time religion than to stay within the church himself. I think his name was Ernest Lefebvre. And he started a little seminary where they kept up everything that was done in the Catholic Church before 1964. But the movement never got off the ground. But this is still true some places. You'll find this if you look at the Saturday night ads in the papers, and it will say, especially in the Episcopalian, usually they'll call themselves Anglican, and then they'll say the Book of Common Prayer of 1928. That means they didn't like any changes that have been made since 1928. And you'll find some of these. That's another story. Okay. But then came, with all the changes, then came, virtually, I suppose you could say, for in certain cases, almost a disaster that took place in the church. The churches, the changes came very quickly, and they came in a very unexpected kind of way. And probably the most dramatic change that occurred in the church in the New Time Religion was a precipitous decline in the number of priests and sisters, of the priests and nuns, just a huge number. Some of them retired, and their places weren't filled. Some of them protested over this or that particular issue or discipline or something else, but that wasn't a major thing. Some of them got mad because the church seemed to move too slowly on some issues like the peace issue or justice issues, like unionizing and so on. But basically it was because of the vow of celibacy. I don't think there's any question that was the case. We have on our faculty, well, one's retired now, we have two ex-priests. And it's fascinating to listen to them on why they left, and they talk about it very freely. And who was Jim Talbin? In sociology, he said one reason he left when he was in seminary, and they believe very strongly in a well-educated clergy. We've been talking about that. He said in seminary, when we had a seminar on St. Thomas Aquinas, we had to discuss in Latin. He said that was a real challenge. He said, what except for language drill, what did that have to do with anything? And but that was simply because it had always been done. St. Thomas, in Latin and all the rest, but the number here, and I want to get cover all this ground, the number was enormous. So I'm using here Scott Appleby. He has the Study of American Catholicism Institute in Notre Dame, and he's got the statistics, and these were of 2 years ago. In 1960, which was sort of the high point, I say with old-time religion, there were, 52,700 priests. This had gone by 1995 from 52,700 down to 45,000 priests. In other words, and it has to be given into account that the Catholic Church increased in total membership by 20 million people in that same time, with immigrants and with birth rate and all the rest of things, coming in from the Caribbean and coming in from Mexico, especially. Some from Asia also, there are some Hmong Catholics and so on. But the total Catholic population in this country went up 20 million people in a space of about 15 years. But the number of priests that were, you know, still in their offices declined from 52,700 to 45,000. It was even greater with the sisters. It went from 165,000, I'm rounding off just a little bit here, it went from 165,000 nuns to 90,000 in that same period of time. The number of children in parochial schools went way down with this, in spite of the fact that the total population went up. Today, the number of seminarians has gone down to 5,500, and there are simply many more openings than there are priests able to fill this, and that creates all kinds of problems that are going on even today.
By the way, Catholic schools and certain sociological configurations are growing in Minnesota anyway, and I think that that's a change. But it has an interesting sort of twist, that the demand for them in the suburbs and exurbia for Catholic schools, because in most places in Midwest, these are quality schools. And so the demand here beyond the Catholic Church, that they are very popular.
Right, is public dissatisfaction for good reasons sometimes and for poor reasons grows about public schools. They want to send their children to parochial schools or to private schools, including the Catholic ones. Mm-hmm. I know I taught a program that's in the great books, and we could almost always tell when we were for freshmen, we could almost always tell when we had Catholic kids coming there. They knew how to discuss, and they knew how to read primary sources, and they were much more disciplined than many of the kids who came from private schools, and I think, or the public schools, and I think that's a good point to raise. But in a lot of other cases, this has meant parishes have had to slow down, they've had to cut back, they can't always have the priest, there all the time. There's one reason, one solution to this is trying to bring in priests from other countries, just like we've done with MDs. Didn't you say you had an Asiatic or a Korean for your doctor?
My both of them. One was Korean, one was Chinese.
There were a shortage of MDs in this country, and there certainly is a shortage of priests.
In South Dakota, we have all kinds of Polish priests.
Right. I like the story. I think I told it the other one, but this has made a difference in the churches. There was a lady who was interviewed on CBS because her church in Detroit had just been cut back. They have an enormous problem with finances. And so on, and that she understood that they had to close down her church because they just didn't have enough money in the parishes, and I think they cut down about a third. And in Chicago, they Brennan Inn had to shut down lots of churches. And it was interesting the problems he had to go through. He had been trying to tell people for a long time that they have to give more money if they want to keep the private schools. Nothing much happened, and then finally, when he finally gave the orders, then they got all excited. They wanted to impeach him or whatever it was, excommunicate him and all the rest, because they thought that he wasn't doing his job, but he had been doing his job all the time. Well, anyway, there was this lady in this Polish part of Detroit who was interviewed on the internet about the closing the church, and she said, "I know why we have to close our church, but," she said, "you know what?" She said, "I'll miss my Friday night Polish bingo blessing." As an example of this, and to her, that was important. I love that. That story. Okay, so the drop in membership is one very important thing. The other one, and Applebee's got some very alarming statistics on it, there's been a huge decline in revenue coming into the church. He says on the basis, let's see the figure here, on the basis of a family, let's say a family earns $40,000 a year in this country, the average family giving is a family, they give $276 a year out of the salary of $40,000. Mormons do better. If you read that piece on the Mormons, they do better than that. But it's gone down, this sort of thing. And many of the Catholic social service agencies have to cut back because of this. They've got this huge number, and they just don't have the revenue. And now it's going to be interesting. I don't know the answer to this more than anybody else. Now with the new enormous changes that have occurred, in our welfare system, and cutting back from the government and all the rest, Clinton and the Republicans seem to think that the churches are going to take up some of this. Mm-hmm. And the problem is that the churches don't have the revenue to do it. In many cases, volunteers, fine. But in terms of, for training, for jobs, and for single-parent families, and all the other things, the poor, the destitute, the homeless, all these things, the churches simply don't give these kind of resources. And it isn't really getting any better. And Applebee makes the point that if we don't do anything, the worst thing we can do here is not do anything about it. And they know this, but it's very difficult to make that kind of change. Okay, I think that's important. And another major change that has occurred in the church has become, in terms of politics, has become polarized. I mean, the liberal, moderate, conservative, you know, spectrum in this country in politics is true also in the Catholic Church. You'll find some very far way out left wing, if you want to call them liberal, radical, and you'll find some ultra conservatives within the church, and they argue and carry on within the church over, you know, issues that are of national importance with taxation or foreign policy, and that helps divide the church. You bring your political agenda into your local congregation, and you divide it over those things, whereas the local congregation would probably do better if it could concentrate on, you know, local issues or on doctrinal issues or on spiritual kind of issues. But the church is very polarized over this, and the first thing that happens when a person comes up for, you know, like your bishop, for a promotion is, you know, how does he stand? I mean, you know, on this issue or that issue. And very, very difficult sort of thing. Okay. Another one is that they're not, and I'm going to say some good things here at the end. I'm not going through the troubles now. But another one is very difficult for Catholics to attract young people and youth. The image is one which is, you know, sober, conservative, and all the rest, and they try very hard to make it interesting for young people, especially teenagers and young adults, and it's very, very difficult to do. There is the old pattern, which is always at work, which always has been at work, that they drop out, you know, in Protestant and Catholic circles both, you drop out virtually after confirmation, and then you start coming back about 14, 15, whatever it is, and then you start coming back again once you're married and have children and you want them brought up in the faith. And they've got all the statistics to prove this beyond any, you know, any doubt at all, this is the case. They don't have many people 18 to 25 or 25, and then it starts so somewhat coming up again. And they try to think, have things like singles clubs and in the churches, and I think that's fine. I got to speak to one in Minneapolis once, and I didn't know this was a singles group and what you might call virtually a dating bureau. And I went through my usual song and dance and all the rest of the things, and what they were interested in much more was, you know, other stuff. And about the second question, I began to pick this up, that this was a dating sort of thing. And you know, the way to put it is, thank goodness they want to do it within the church, that they want to marry within the church. What's wrong with that? I met my wife, Bruce, up here. She's not here now, but we are a whole village romance. We were in 1986. We had the Marty Hogan Vespers for our service, for our wedding service, right? That's how Holden we are. We bleed green and what would be the Holden colors here? Green and something, and white, I suppose, for the winter time. Okay. And of course, enormous problems over the liturgy. I just have to mention that to give you some indication of how difficult that one is. And that one isn't so, you know, going away very easily. On this. But the good news is, and Appleby points it out too, the Catholic Church has always been in trouble. It's always been in conflict. It's always had very serious difficulties. In the 1840s up in Boston, there were Protestants who were burning the Catholic seminary. So one of the great leaders was Lyman Beecher. He was sort of the number one preacher in this country at that time, and he led a movement. They marched over to Charleston, where there was a Catholic seminary, and burned it down. And yes, really, it was just an amazing thing. And for a long time, the hostility in the church was against politicians. The first Catholic president we had, of course, was JFK. And we, in 1928, the Democrats tried with
Al Smith,
right. And he lost because he was a Catholic, and he lost because he was, as we call it, a wet, you know, on prohibition. And who was it, Will Rogers used to say about the prohibition issue in this country, as long as the voters could stagger up to the poll and vote, they'd vote dry. I think that was the way it put it. Anyway, it wasn't until JFK came, and then I'm drawing here from what Cardinal Cushing, his archbishop, said, one major reason JFK won, he wasn't a very good Catholic. Right, and that whole issue came up, and now it disappeared very quickly. Just one example, 1968. Our friend Hubert Humphrey ran for president, and his vice presidential candidate was Senator Muskie. Muskie was a Catholic. This did not even come up. This was the first time a vice president had been, as a Catholic, had been nominated. And the Muskie thing didn't even surface. Now now we even have Greek Orthodox. Now we even have women, Catholic women, Ferrero. What happens, what's happening here? But anyway, that's not an issue any longer, but the old time versus the new time religion. But he says that the church is going to make it. And he says that, he asks the question, and I want to read this because it's so well done here. He said, why with all this, I promise you this is what we would do, why with all this, why do they stay? I got it. We'll say goodnight.
Is it behind you? There's something else on
there. There's something behind you. Never have I get carried over here. Why are they making that? Okay. This is a Father Greeley. Catholicism has great stories because at the center of its heritage is what he calls sacramentalism, the conviction that God discloses himself in the objects and events and persons of ordinary life. Hence, Catholicism is willing to risk stories about angels and saints and souls in purgatory and Mary, the mother of Jesus, and stained glass windows and statues and stations of the cross and rosaries and medals and the whole panoply of images and devotions that were so offensive to the austere leaders of the Reformation. Moreover, the Catholic heritage is also the elaborate ceremonial rituals that mark the passing of the year. Midnight Mass, Easter Vigil, First Communion, May Crown, Lent, Advent, Grammar School graduation, and the festivals of the saints. It embraces all these things, Catholicism has embraced the whole of human life cycle and sacraments. I like that sort of thing. With it. It's the sacrament of reconciliation and all the other things. Despite all the problems, when people are trying to interpret life and the problems and the conflicts and all the rest, the Catholic way of interpreting this through the sacraments and through the whole life cycle things is the best one they have available for them. That they understand this and it simply rings true. And what I like with the Catholics, and this is true in the Lutheran Church too, the phrase I like, my own self, and it comes from the liturgy, is there's always time for the amendment of life. You can start over again. With the sacraments, you can start over again. Time for the amendment of life. Sometimes, in evangelical teaching, that you're always at a crossroads. Well, okay, so you take the wrong crossroad. That means you can't ever come back again. I mean, that's what's wrong with the crossroads metaphor. You just go down this way, and then if that's the bad way, then how could you ever come back? Okay. And what I like about the Catholic and the Lutheran one, Episcopalian, is there's time for the amendment of life. You go and confess, and you can start over again. And that's very important. Okay, I have promised the joke. And this,
yes.
This, I have to say, this is 10 minutes before the watch call, but this is a good one. And some of you are on the internet, and there are various, nets that come along, or lists that come along, and you get those. Okay. And this is from there. Anyway, it's a priest and a rabbi, okay? Priest and a rabbi, both servants of God. They were good friends. The priest wanted to go on vacation, and he was talking to the rabbi, but he said, I really need to go, but I don't think I can, because I have confession, and people really depend on me for confession. And the rabbi says, well, let's think about this, and maybe we can work out something where I can help you out on confession. Remember, in confession, you can't see who the other one is, okay? So they talked about this for a while. A little later, the priest said, I know what we can do. I'll sit with you at confession next week, and I'll listen to what you're doing, and I'll pay attention, and then you go on your vacation, and I'll act as, have you heard this one?
Yeah.
Okay, has he heard it? Oh, good.
I have.
I'll act as the priest, and nobody will ever know. That's the point, but nobody will ever know. Okay. And the priest said, okay, that sounds good. So they sat in, and people came and went and everything else, and suddenly a woman came in. Father, forgive me, for I have sinned. And he said, what have you done? And she said, I've committed adultery. And he said, how many times? And she said, three times this week. And he said, say five Hail Marys, put $10, no, what, say, oh, 10 Hail Marys, put $5 in the collection plate, and go and sin no more. Okay, the rabbi listened to this and everything else and what the priest had done. And then about two, three people later, a woman came in, Father, forgive me, for I have sinned. What have you done? I have committed adultery. And he said, how many times? And she said, three times this week. And she said, what should I do? And he said, say 10 Hail Mary, put $5 in the collection plate, and go and sin no more. And the rabbi nodded, and he said, I've got this down. I'm not sure what we can do here. And so the priest went on his vacation. And so it came Saturday, time for confession, all the rest. The rabbi was in the box, and listened to some people. And finally, a woman came in, and she says, Father, I have sinned. Forgive me, for I have sinned. And he said, what have you done? And he said, I have committed adultery. And he said, how many times? And the woman said, one time this week. And the rabbi says, okay, go out and put $5 in the collection plate and do it two more times. We've got three for five special this week.
You can't beat that.
And at first I was a little nervous of telling this to an elder house group. They broke up. They just... that's good.
You probably have some Jewish people in your audience.
Oh, yeah, sure. What is it Moses and Jesus says? Let Moses invest, That's a good one.
Right. If possible, I'd like to make a brief comment.
Sure.
What you said, I really appreciate what you said. I think I can help to illustrate what you said, because the parish I joined is a parish in Crossroads. I joined an inner city parish, and it's sort of a disreputable parish in many ways. They have a dining hall downstairs where they feed the homeless. And they also probably have the largest number of married ex-priests of any parish in the city of Portland, or possibly in the diocese. Mm-hmm. So it's somewhat disreputable.
Yeah.
The priest retired because of ill health, and the bishop did not appoint a priest because of the priest shortage that you were referring to. For a period of 3 years, the parish had no priest. It still has no appointed full-time priest. But there's been a polarization in that community, partially as a result of this. We left that community because of the political polarization that was taking place and the power struggle, and it was kind of like a naked power struggle. It was very unpleasant. We had just joined the church. I joined this church because it was a community there was a tremendous outpouring of love in that community that was so attractive to me. And subsequently, it became a battlefield for the warring factions of the liberals and the conservatives within the church, with no priest, no head. Mm-hmm.
Right.
They had like circuit rider priests, you know, the Jesuits filled in, you know, and so forth, so on for mass. And in the meantime, they had this person that was a woman who got herself into a position of power. Mm-hmm. Because she was a woman, many people, feminists in the church, wanted her to be in a position of power. And she was not the right person. The person that was our teacher was also a woman who was an ideal example of what Christian love should be, I think. She was married to an ex-priest. They're gone. This is a sad story of what happened to one parish that is a perfect example of what you were talking
right,
about.
Right. There have been others. And it usually takes strong leadership. That's what it takes, and you didn't have a leader.
Yeah. Exactly.
And
right.
They would
have a body without a head.
Right. And sometimes the archbishops don't know, they're supposed to be the troubleshooters. They don't know what to do. I mean, you can't just blame the archbishop, because sometimes they just don't know. And sometimes they're so afraid of offending one faction that what they wind up is doing nothing. And that the...
This archbishop that was there, is the one that eventually went down to La Veda, which went down to San Francisco. He was very conservative. Mm-hmm. He knew what to do. He did not like this parish. And so
let it blow up.
Yeah, let it blow up, which it did. And we were on the pastoral council and everything. Because we were ex-Protestants, they treated us like we were, visiting royalty, which was also silly. it was ridiculous because... we must have something to say or something. But we did finally, because they wouldn't even. But what we were also in leadership in Renew, and what came out was the angst, as they kept talking about their angst. And they never got anywhere, but their angst about how they grew up in the Catholic Church and all the problems. They had the most difficulty because they were now supposed to take responsibility for their own religion, quote, their own faith, and that terrified them.
Instead of being told everything what to do by a priest.
And they didn't know what, but they would not leave. They would stay there and fight and fight and fight, and it was like my vocation was delinquent kids, I had a youth care center for girls, and it finally one Sunday I just said, I cannot go to this place any longer. These are like a bunch of delinquent kids. And they were adults. Many of them were ex-priests and all that, but they still had those same kind of almost like institutionalized kids. You know, we got them out of the institutions. Well, these were like adults that had been in an institution. Now they were free. They didn't know what to do.
No, they have, it's very difficult to find reconciliation methods within, you know, within a church that for such a long time was so hierarchical.
But the other thing is about your sacraments. Yeah. You know, one of the things that in the Catholic Church, and I didn't really have that much feeling about sacraments one way or another, but I know they work because my husband, on Ash Wednesday, his father died and he never was able to reconcile. This was through the 60s and so forth because he was down in the Columbia, whatever. But anyway, through that, just that sacrament of putting the ashes on his forehead.
That's not a sacrament.
Well, but it's part of the sacramental, yes.
Right, the sacramental.
It's a ritual.
A ritual. It broke that.
Yeah.
And he was healed in many ways. So I can't say that it has nothing to do, I mean, that it isn't powerful. Those kinds of things. I mean, all of the counseling, whatever else, didn't do it. But those, that ritual and the sacraments are very important. We knew more about the Bible, but there, I mean, the two, that's why now that we're going to a Lutheran and Catholic Church, and we have Father Matt, who is a Franciscan, and he's wonderful. I mean, he doesn't, any of this garbage.
He's not interested in it.
And so it's a marriage of the best of both worlds. Well, we are very blessed.
You bet. That's remarkable.
And, of course, that was an answer to prayer.
In Northfield, they solved the problem. This one fellow, he was born a Catholic and had a family and everything else. And by the time he was about 55, his wife died. So he went back to seminary and got ordained. And now we have Father Joel, and he's terrific. He brings out all that experience.
Ah.
You know, and he's going to be celebrated. Isn't that big? All that experience. And now, seminary, I should have talked about Catholic seminaries. They've changed enormously. You know, it's not just a place, for one thing, it's not just a place where you will learn to be a preacher. And they have, and another thing is mostly people in second careers, 40s and 50s, who have come. When I was at the one in Berkeley, there was one student who was just out of college. Everybody else was at least 35, 40, 50, with this sort of thing. And they are trying to be adaptable to the new needs that are taking place. And somebody like Father Joe brings all that experience. He may not be theologically sophisticated, but the people love him, and he's able to reach the people. Like you say,
well, we just also, there's a movement internationally to change some of these things. People are signing, like the celibacy issue and all of those that are just keeping the Catholic Church so stuck. I don't know if anything will happen.
I don't know any more about the future than anybody else, but my guess is that they will eventually have priests who can marry, but I don't see them ever changing on the women ordination, because that would be admitting that they've been wrong for 1900 years.
But never say never when you come to Catholic Church.
Well, not as long as as long as
not as long as
there.
No, I know. It's not going to be in my life. It's not going to be in this Pope's tenure, and it's not going to be in my lifetime.
I
think several lifetimes beyond.
He's very good at evangelism, but he's very stuck in other ways.
Yeah. Well, that'll some comes on sometime just before the Orthodox Jewish community ordains Jewish rabbi.
Okay, it's time.
Thank you very much.
They suggested we eat before the big crowd.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
The masses,
and hopefully it'll be outdoors.
I think that's a good idea.
I used to hear about Archbishop George is at times, and I've heard very little about him, and it's a big concern because that's the biggest archdiocese in the country, and most powerful. And Bernard is really one of the most remarkable people in the church of tradition.
Well, I think you'll be hearing good things. He carried it up about one of his things that he did was because he had so many Hispanics in his last studies, he went down to Mexico to learn the language, learn the culture and things. So he's a people's person. And he doesn't stay in his, whatever, his little cubicle. He gets out there and he is really involved and he's open. And so I think that he will be good for Chicago. We hated to lose him, but we finally got someone who made it.
Sorry about that.
You know, but it really doesn't affect us. The peace issue was the biggest thing. It was the Gulf War Sunday when he split from the church we had been attending because they were singing songs.
Oh, really?
In the Protestant church.
Oh, no.
The Lord is on our side.
Is that
right?
Oh,
guys. And so that's how we came into the Catholic church, basically.
Oh.
And because they are so strong on the peace issue. And so the journey has been quite interesting. And his dad taught it to Northfield at St. Olaf. He was a music instructor. Whitman. His name was Melvin Whitman.
No, I don't know the name of that.
Yeah, I know. And so he lived, of course, on the campus and everything. So to me, all of the divisions are silly. I mean, I grew up in the Nazarene Church. We're the only Catholics in our family. But it doesn't make any difference to me, you know.
Yeah.
The common ground is what is important in my relationship to the Lord and how I live it out. And I'm Catholic now, it's fine. I mean, sometimes I forget what group I'm sitting with. If the Spirit is there, the Spirit is there.
Especially a place like Holden, but that's too many places now. You don't think about that. And all these Catholic elements and the liturgy here.
Right.
You talk about conversations. They'll come from, you know, Nazarene tradition and Baptist and Pentecostal.
I went to a charismatic Baptist for many years.
Yeah.
For 20 years, basically. Stuff is wonderful. I just really enjoy it because you break down those barriers and come to the common ground. A little gal that just graduated, she's marvelous, and she and Father Max are so,
to me, that compliment very,
to her. He can give a homily of the fewest words and get right to that. And so caring. And she is, she's very dramatic, you know, many things. She did a thing about John the Baptist, and he had on her platter, and she had props and everything, you know. But it's a small church, but we can get who's Lutheran, who's Catholic, because it started, it's been there for 10 years, the mission of the astronomers. And one couple...